Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you. This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.
The one thing that I do bang on about a lot is about the invisible wealth that IP creates in a business.
Hello and welcome to episode 399 of Business Live on Sheffield Live FM and DAB Radio and wherever you get your podcasts. Intellectual property is today's topic, and we're joined by Liz Ward, an IP expert. How can you protect your IP? What should you do if someone infringes it? How can you ensure you don't accidentally infringe somebody else's? And what are the implications for creatives of artificial intelligence? How do you value your IP? There's lots in here, and Liz is generous with her knowledge. And after the interview, we've got some events and funding news for businesses and social entrepreneurs too, including a 25th anniversary for Sheffield Live. But let's hear from Liz Ward.
We're open for Business Live.
Welcome. Thanks ever so much for joining us. Can you just introduce yourself and Virtuoso Legal in your own words?
In my own words, well, I set up Virtuoso Legal, it's 18 years ago. Before that, I worked in a number of bigger law firms. And before I became a lawyer altogether, I'm actually a biochemist by background and I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. I got bored with doing that. I wanted to do something else. And I retrained and became a lawyer. And the natural thing to go for was IP, because intellectual property, obviously, it made the most of my scientific background. It made the most of my knowledge of all sorts of technology. And so I graduated as a lawyer into intellectual property in one of the very big, was national at the time, is now an international law firm in Leeds. Spent a few more years in a couple of other law firms in Leeds, and then started on my own in 2007. And I can't believe it's 18 years in May.
Absolutely.
Since I made that jump. It's been quite a journey, let me tell you.
It must have been a journey in that time, because so much has changed, which will have affected the area of intellectual property during the course of those 18 years.
I think the law's changed massively. I do a lot of litigation. Procedure has changed hugely. I'm very reliant on a lot of my juniors these days for keeping me up to date with those sorts of things. But I think the profession has changed, and I think the market dynamics have changed too. And it's interesting to have been on that crest of that wave, because when I started in 2007, there weren't that many people who'd started out on their own doing a specialist subject like I did, which was in intellectual property. There were lots of people who were high street lawyers who'd gone to be, their own boss, etc. But to actually go into a specialisation. But the thing that motivated me to do it was I realised so many SMEs actually needed that advice, but they weren't getting it, because a lot of innovation happens in the UK in smaller businesses. And those smaller businesses are the ones who I saw them scale and grow, when I was in bigger law firms. I'd see them get investment, I'd see them move on, I'd see them get bought and sold. And I'd see so many of them had made really fundamental errors at the start of their journey that really impacted them later on down the line. They were invisible to them to start with. But that was very much one of my motivators, was that SMEs in this country deserved really good quality legal advice from an IP specialist. And that was my great motivator. I think it's got much more difficult to be a lawyer now in all sorts of ways. I think the barriers that have been put up to people starting their own practices have become ever higher and higher. And there's a lot of things that mitigate against you, the regulations, the kind of compliance with accounts, the compliance with insurance, all those sorts of things make it actually quite difficult now, which is why we're seeing a consolidation of and merger of a lot of bigger firms.
That's really interesting, that element of consolidation mergers because of those barriers. I want to turn to something that you just said, though, in terms of businesses not acting to protect their IP perhaps early enough, for example.
Yeah,
is it ever too early to start thinking about protecting?
No. And when I started off in the law, which is sort of 30 years ago now, I'd say to people, well, you might want to start trading, see how your brand gets along, and then trademark it. But there's no way now with the global market and everything going straight online that you do that. People need to get in early and get their mark registered or at least get the toe in the door with an application. Again, with patents and things like that, you have to be ahead of the curve. You can't see whether or not something works and then take it to all these different, potential buyers and then try and patent it. You need to get your toe in the door early. And that's important.
That's really, really important then. And that then perhaps speaks...
It's vital. Yeah. It's vital. If you commercialise some technology which you want to patent, by the time you've gone out there and sold it to the public or talked about it or taken it to a trade fair or taken it to an exhibition or spoken at a conference about it, you're too late then to get a patent on it because it's been put in the public domain. And one of the essential ingredients of a patent is that you keep it secret until the patent is published and then people can openly challenge it.
Yes, indeed. And I suppose that speaks to something that you also said in terms of noticing that lots of SMEs...
Noticing it, yeah. It's getting it there that's the big problem. People know they may have one patent, they may not think about the strategy of how they're going to handle that patent, the strategy of whether or not to take it international, what the potential advantages are to do that, and also what the costs are going to be, because the costs of IP tend to be front-loaded.
Yes, indeed. So what are the biggest mistakes that people make? You said businesses make a lot of mistakes when it comes to doing this, so obviously not thinking about this early enough is one. But what else? What do you pick up on?
Not recognising that they've made an innovation is the big hurdle, I think, for a lot of people. They don't realise that they've actually leapt ahead in the market and that they are ahead and that margin by which they have achieved success is something that's protectable.
Right.
And so what are the common mistakes that I see? The common elephant traps, obviously not getting things registered fast enough or not taking advice soon enough. Poor contracts are something that I see a lot of. People will think that their employment or their director's contracts or whatever have got an element of covering the IP in there. They often don't.
Yep.
They will subcontract things out because, again, now, you know, we don't employ people. Lots of people have got a small team of whatever, and then they'll subcontract out, say, software development or design elements or certain parts of that whole innovative concept, and they'll not necessarily make sure that they get the rights assigned back to them. That's a big problem that we see. People think because they've paid for something that they automatically own it, and they don't. So those are the kind of things that we see. Again, back to contracts, poor licensing agreements, not thought through terms and conditions, not thought through export arrangements as well. These are all elephant traps for people.
And so if a business owner is listening to this and thinking, crikey, she's right, I haven't even thought about this, and yet I have put this innovative work out into the world, I've been trading for a while, where do they start? Do you help them to audit that sort of thing? Or?
We do audits of that, and we help them just really think about it and streamline it. But I'll give you a classic case in point, and this is a practical example, because I always think practical examples are much better to
Definitely.
Sort of remember things by. Say, for example, you design shop fronts, you design point of sale purchase arrangements, and say you design shop interiors.
Yeah.
You might say, for example, get a big retailer to say, oh, can you please put together a concept for me to think about? And you will put a lot of effort into that with the expectation that you get the job and that you then get the servicing of that job. You then get the implementation of it. And if you don't get the implementation of it, your designs can go off to a third party. And there are very simple ways of circumventing that. For example, when you hand your designs over, you make sure that you've handed them over under a non-disclosure arrangement, that they've got confidential written all over them, that they've got copyright written over them, that you've got some kind of contractual agreement in place that if they don't go ahead with your particular project, then they don't use them. because I've seen it on a number of occasions and it's heartbreaking to see it. Really clever designers, engineers, innovators have gone to somebody else with a proposal, even pharmaceuticals,
yes.
You know, particularly interesting looking agent or molecule. They'll take that off to a third party and then they won't hear anything more from that third party. And they think, well, we just didn't get the business. And then 6 months later, 12 months later, they'll find their concept actually has been used and deployed. And sometimes their calculations, their drawings, their ideas have been effectively stolen.
So they discover that to their great horror.
Yes.
And if they've done everything right, they've used an NDA, for example,
yes.
as you described, how do they go about addressing that?
Well, it's much easier from an enforcement point of view. If you've got a contract that says, you know, you won't disclose it and somebody does disclose it to a third party, you've got a contract there or some other similar contract terms that say you won't exploit it. So you've got a contract there to pull on. You've also got things like, for example, your copyright. So you're seeing a circle even on ideas that you've put together, even if it's a text. I mean, say, for example, you're a writer, you know, you do some brilliant piece of text or proposal. You wouldn't want somebody to just go off and use it. But if it had got your copyright notice on it, whoever used it would be on notice of the fact that you were the originator.
Indeed, indeed. So they're on notice then.
So they're on notice, and it's easier to enforce something like that because you can say, look, you knew that was my copyright.
Yes.
It's got my name on it.
One of the questions that some people have said to me when I've been working with businesses or presenting on the radio or whatever, people have talked about, well, this is all very well and good, but if they're a relatively small business, if they're a sole trader even, or a micro SME with a relatively low turnover and the infringement has been done by a massive or a much larger business, they sometimes can say, well, we think we'd win, but we can't necessarily afford to go
to challenge
to challenge.
Right. It's a big problem, actually, for people. And one of the things that I'm a big fan of is intellectual property legal expenses insurance. And I quite often speak to companies about that because it's the old adage of an ounce of prevention being better than a pound of cure. So with the right kind of a policy there, and there needn't be an expensive policy, but it needs to be quite tightly worded. You need to go to somebody who really knows what they're doing from an insurance point of view. And there are some sort of entry-level type policies that I could recommend to people. Then they will have in their back pocket something that they can use in defence of their IP. And I can't state how useful that is.
That sounds remarkably useful. And is that available on a retrospective basis? So someone listening to this thinking, gosh, I really should have done something about this. I'm going to do something about it now. I'm going to look at one of those policies that Liz has recommended.
You don't need to get it from the start, but you do obviously need to get it before you've got a claim.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So someone could set something up and they are then protected.
They are protected, yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things. Yes, it's a few thousand pounds in a premium, but versus tens of thousands of pounds, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds if it ever comes to court action.
Yes, absolutely. That's a brilliant tip and well worth considering then for folk listening to this. And the people who are listening will be running quite a diverse range of businesses in the knowledge economy and in manufacturing and in distribution and all sorts of different types of business.
Yes.
So it is quite difficult to be generalist here, but I wonder if you could sort of give your top pieces of advice when it comes to thinking about protecting intellectual property. I think probably number one is it's not never too early to think about it. And number two might well be, if you haven't thought about it, you could get insurance so that you're protected and covered in terms of the legal cost if you need to enforce something.
Yes.
What else should someone who is listening to this and thinking, I've been trading for a while, I've come up with some sort of totally unique processes, ways of doing things, or actual physical innovations, what else should people be thinking of?
Well, I think there's two key things that spring to mind here. Number one is to have a strategy of innovation, a strategy of protection. And the second one is a good suite of contractual documents around it.
Yes.
So if you are innovating, again, a few years ago, I saw a company who were making packaging, unique packaging. But they were doing it, they were making things that were really unusual and unique and very attractive. But they were doing it because customers had asked them to do it. And you got into this quite interesting scenario, which we see quite often, which is, who's developed this?
Oh, yes.
Because I'm the manufacturer, you're the creative, yes. You're coming to me and saying, this is how I want the packaging to look like, this is how I want the design to function. What can you do for me, Liz? And I'll go, well, here you go, I've got a few ideas here. And of course, then I, as a manufacturer, I take those ideas, I make them, so I make my money out of doing that. But there's not necessarily a clear ownership issue, ownership situation there. And I, as a manufacturer, might go, oh, well, you know, I've got Fred down the road. He might like to have a look at some of that packaging too. That'd suit him fine.
Yes, indeed.
And then I take off Jim's idea and I go and showcase it to Fred. And that happens a lot with Chinese manufacturers.
Oh, I bet it does.
I mean, it happens in the UK too.
Yes. I bet it happens a huge amount. With, you know, I think I've had the idea. You think you've actually turned the idea into something practical, and you know, you've had the idea really. So we end up squabbling. And,
well, indeed, we do. And you might think, well, do you know what? Liz has got really expensive with their manufacturing. I want to take it to Joe down the road because he's promised me a much better deal. And then I go, well, hang on a minute. I've done all the innovation, all the R&D here.
Yes.
You know, those are the kind of discussions that sometimes people have.
So you talked about having a sort of innovation strategy and thinking about contracts, appropriate contracts.
Yes, yeah.
So in that situation, I come to you with an idea, but you turn that idea into something practical and make it happen. Yeah. Do people sometimes share the ownership of the intellectual property?
They do. It can be inherently difficult to share things like that.
Yeah.
I once, a few years ago, saw a big big manufacturer who exported a lot to Southeast Asia.
Yes.
Had a joint IP, right, joint trademark, actually, with somebody in Southeast Asia. And the agent in Southeast, the distributor in Southeast Asia, thought, you know what, I own the rights to this trademark. I'll get a much cheaper product created locally. And they lost their whole Southeast Asia market because of this jointly owned trademark. So that can be inherently difficult. So not only did they have to rebrand in that territory, but they also had to find another distributor. So it's quite a that was quite a significant financial loss.
I bet. Yes. Gosh. Okay. Well, we've got some top tips there that people running businesses can use and can think about. And I want to ask you about another area of your expertise in a moment or two when it comes to businesses defending themselves if they find a cease and desist letter landing on the doormat or anything like that. But before we go there, I thought it would be worth picking up on a couple of things about Virtuoso Legal itself. You've mentioned 18-year anniversary, set up the business in 2007. So that's phenomenal. Congratulations. How big's the business now?
Oh, we're not massive. We're still a small sort of team. There's five fee earners, as it were.
Yes.
So five lawyers acting on behalf of clients. We're not massive. But we do what we do deeply. So, you know, we do high court litigation. We do everything from kind of licensing through to registering trademarks. So IP is really our bag. One of my personal things that I really like to help people with is strategy.
Yes.
Because that I know that can make such a difference to a company. If we can sit down and we can map out some kind of strategy as to where they're going to go with their IP and how they're going to exploit it. And I find that quite an intellectual challenge. I find that quite useful. Things like, for example, we had a plastics manufacturer. Well, no, they weren't manufacturer. They'd innovated some new technology in plastics, and we were looking at different markets, and we were looking, for example, at where they were going to get patent and trademark cover. And I said to them, well, look, the big manufacturers actually out in Southeast Asia, I think where you need patent cover, where you need trademark cover, is out there as well, because those potentially are big export markets, but more importantly for you, they're big manufacturing markets.
Indeed.
And they will export globally from there. So you're going to have to get this protected locally so that it's not abused.
Most definitely, yes, that makes sense. So that was a sort of light bulb moment for them in terms of thinking of their...
Very much so. And not one that I think a lot of people had thought about because they hadn't looked at the market. We tend to think, don't we, that, hey, our markets are all the developed world, but they're not.
No, indeed.
You know, and it's not that Southeast Asia isn't the developed world. It is, but it's not something that people automatically think, well, I actually need IP cover there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so it's helping them with that strategy and making them opening their eyes to opportunities like this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, great.
We're open for business life.
Accelerate your small business at Stadium Workspace, a free event that's part of Business Finance Week, hosted by British Business Bank. You'll meet the region's leaders in health tech and life sciences, discover cutting-edge innovation, and connect with potential investors. The date is Tuesday, 30th September. The venue, Sheffield Olympic Legacy Park. The cost, nothing. And the opportunity, potentially priceless. To unlock business opportunities, search online for Business Finance Week.
And is there a risk that businesses will cut back on things that they should be doing in terms of investments, for example, in protecting their IP?
Definitely.
Or perhaps use AI-related tools or try to offshore in a different way. Do you feel...
I think there is. I do see an increasing trend of people trying to DIY their legal services, and there's quite a lot of help out there. But... you don't know what you don't know. And I've seen some people fall into endless elephant traps over it as well.
Yes.
And I think AI is a bit of a false god because, again, I've seen people do their own, you know, letters before claim or claims or whatever using AI. Well, good luck with that one, because from what I can see, it doesn't do a very good job.
Right. That's really
interesting. So you need to be careful. I mean... if you are a lawyer, obviously a lot of our professional providers have given us AI tools, which work quite well in the law. Mm. But of course, there was a joke, wasn't there, not too long ago about how AI would cite false cases and things like that, fictitious cases,
yes,
to support an argument.
Yes.
Well, you know, there's an element of that still goes on.
Yeah, that's terrifying. And I think a lot of people are also terrified that AI is harvesting or cannibalising intellectual property. So writers and creatives and artists are...
It's a big problem for copyright creators, massive problem. In fact, we've just done a blog on it, which, you know, talks about the risks. And the one thing that I would say to listeners is be very careful about what you put on your website, you know, and what you put out there generally for people to trawl through and have a look at. You can opt out of, there's ways of means of opting out of AI tools dragging your content in, but your content will get dragged in.
So we will link to that blog from the show notes. So if you're listening to this, look up the show notes for this podcast, and we'll link to resources like Liz's blog about protecting your copyright there from being harvested by AI. But I wonder if you can just sort of give us a sort of very succinct kind of quick how to protect yourself in that event. You know, if you're publishing wonderful value adding material on websites, like lots of businesses do, sort of giving people some really, really valuable advice, and you want to, or you're a creative publishing things on your website, how do you protect yourself? You mentioned, you know, you can protect yourself from that content being dragged into AI. What do you do?
Well, you can opt out of the AI bots that drag the content in. So I think that's one thing that you can do. I would just say make sure that things are behind a bit of a wall or some, you know, rather than give things away, make sure that you get an email address or they're not actually publicly available content. I think that's the key thing.
Yes.
I mean, certainly from marketing in the past, a lot of things have been given away free with the idea that people will then come to you as the expert. And I'm not against that at all. I'm not saying don't do that. I am saying be quite careful about what you do put out there.
Okay. That's great. That's again, food for thought for folk listening to this, Liz. Thank you. I promised I'd ask about what to do to defend yourself if you have perhaps inadvertently infringed copyright or a trademark or intellectual property in another way. So, for example, you might well have had no intent whatsoever to do something, but a letter might land on your desk telling you that your business name or a slogan that you are using or a product that you've put out there is infringing someone. That must cause a great deal of fear and worry for a small business in particular. What should businesses do if that happens to them?
I think you need to get some expert advice. A lot of these things are defendable. You'd be amazed at the number of cease and desist letters that we see, which are somewhat speculative in nature and make assertions that really don't add up to scrutiny. So, for example, somebody might say, well, you're using our name, and you find out actually you were using that particular brand name for 5 years before they ever got their registered trademark, for example. That's a classic. Or you could find out that, in fact, the photograph that they're saying you shouldn't be using isn't, in fact, subject of any kind of restrictions over use or is quite freely available on low-cost websites to sort of, for, what do they call it, thumbnail sketches, yes. That kind of thing. So it's relatively inexpensive to license. I mean, make sure if you're going to use some copyright content that you know where it comes from and that you've got the relevant permissions. That's key.
Yes.
When it comes to things like technology, then, again, it's useful to know what the competition are doing.
Uh-huh.
And some big companies keep a very close eye on what their competitors are doing. So oil companies and so on are forever watching what innovation is going on. Pharmaceutical companies are the same. When it comes to trademark and branding, if you're going for a new brand, have a look round, have a look round yourself, do some Google searches, have a search on social media. When you've decided that that particular name for that particular service or goods is free, then think about getting it trademarked.
Great. Sterling advice there, Liz. Thank you very much. I think that's fantastic. We talked when we prepped for this podcast a little bit about the use of restrictive covenants as well, and we talked about cybersecurity. Now, I wonder whether there's anything that you want to add on that we haven't covered on either of those.
Restrictive covenants are a bit of a movable feast, really, because one thing I would say is if you're employing creative people to work for you, designers and that kind of thing, is when they go off to somebody else, make sure they haven't taken your designs or your copyright material or your, proprietary material with them. That's not uncommon to me to see people move from one organisation to another and all of a sudden, the new organisation's got some very similar looking product out there.
Yep.
So that's one thing in terms of restrictive covenants. They're always a bit difficult to enforce restrictive covenants, but if you've got confidential information, then you can make somebody keep it confidential. But people inevitably will go off with ideas that they've already got in their heads.
Yes.
That's difficult to enforce.
That's a tough one, yeah. Mm. Okay. And, yes, cyber squatting and cyber
security. Cyber squatting, yeah. There's an interesting one. I tell you what's quite an interesting development on this one, and I'm following it quite keenly, actually, because it's all involved with fraud. And I've seen some terrible kind of abuses of our system. Is Companies House is tightening up massively on you starting up a new company. It used to be that anybody could buy a company relatively inexpensively. You could change the details. Nobody, if you put yourself down as Mickey Mouse, nobody checked that you were Mickey Mouse.
No.
Then they didn't check your passport. They didn't check your ID. They didn't check where you lived particularly. Companies House is changing that quite a lot now. So the ID and the kind of importance of who you are for Companies House is essential now for setting up a company. And I'll tell you why that's important. That's important from a financial perspective. Because what some of these rogue traders do, these rogue businesses, is they'll set up and they'll say, we set up a company, now we'll set up a bank account in the same name and we'll start some kind of online fraud going on.
Yep.
So, for example, they will start, one that I've fallen for is like a parking scam.
Mm.
You think you've paid to park, or you think you've paid the congestion charge or whatever, and you find you haven't paid the congestion charge. You've paid some website that looks vaguely like the congestion charge. And sat behind that is a bank that's taking money. And sat behind that is a company that's been legitimately set up. And the directors have not accounted for who they are.
No.
And the bank is taking the money. And the banks haven't been, the financial institutions haven't been perhaps as alert to this as they should be.
Which and is so, astonishing in the age of know
absolutely,
your customer.
Yeah. Absolutely. So these scams have really kind of, proliferated.
Yes.
And I'm hoping now that Companies House have tightened up their procedures and that banks are tightening up their procedures about knowing who their clients are, that we'll see a lot less of that kind of online fraud and scamming.
Let's hope so. I mean, many people will say when it comes to Companies House, about time too. As you say, very easy to set up a business and to say that it's, to give a director's name without a check.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So that's really interesting development. Mm. So lots going on, and people can stay up to date with what is going on through the blogs that you put out there, of course.
Yes.
And you've also written a book, Liz.
Well, I have written a book. That? It's called If You're So Clever, Why Aren't You Rich?
What a brilliant title.
Which is, a question that we all ask ourselves, isn't it? But its subtitle is 10 Ways to Take Your IP to the Bank. Because the one thing that I do bang on about a lot is about the invisible wealth that IP creates in a business. And it's invisible because it's not necessarily seen on the balance sheet.
Hmm.
You can have a list of assets there, but your assets are rarely going to be your trademark portfolio, your patent portfolio, your design right portfolio, but they may actually be the things that are adding value to your business.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is why I've called it invisible wealth. And it's something that I feel very passionately about, because these days we're an innovation economy.
Yes.
We're not manufacturing quite as we used to. We're a services economy much more. We are manufacturing, but the manufacturing we're doing is speciality manufacturing, again, with a big level of IP in it, a big level of secret know-how, as it were, to make something. And I am passionate about people understanding that a bit better, and I've got a number of podcasts out now, which we're rebranding as the Invisible Wealth Podcast, that talk about value, talk about valuation of intangible assets. How do we do that? How do you get insurance? What about music in the economy? How does that all work? How does all these creative things that we do? You look at what we make. We do music, we do software, we do broadcasts, we do marketing, we do branding. All these sort of soft skills that we do are big planks of our economy
now.
Oh,
yes, yes.
Massively. And we don't recognise them. We just don't recognise them as something that a bank will lend against. We don't recognise them as something that can be financed. We just don't recognise them. They're invisible. They're not often invisible to the founders. The founders will be very attached to them.
Yeah.
But once it gets beyond that stage, once a company gets beyond a certain stage, then other countries come in and they snap up those businesses.
They really do. I mean, it happens a huge amount. And as you say, this the economy that we are in the UK, we have a huge creative industry sector.
Mm.
It contributes enormously to GDP, and yet sometimes we don't always give it the recognition and the value that it deserves. Do you help people to sort of, as you say, the founder will know that, will know about that, those that invisible wealth, but do you help them sort of value it so that they can take that valuation?
We do. We help people review what they've got. We help them value what we've got. We work closely with a company called Ingot, who do sort of like an automated software valuation of material, which is now used by banks. But I think the major stumbling block we've got in this economy moving forward is companies get to a certain size and then they're snapped up. They're snapped up by big US corporates. They're snapped up by Chinese big corporates. They're snapped up. we don't scale things in this country as we should do. And there's a whole set of reasons behind that. But a lot of it is because we don't truly back our innovations and we haven't got the financial system or the visionaries, really, to carry on and scale things. I think we do have visionaries, but I think we make life very difficult for them.
Let's back the visionaries. I think that's a real call to action there.
Yes.
Indeed. So anyone listening who thinks, well, Liz touched on a huge amount here, there's a great deal of value in the tips and advice that you've given, and people can find out more by looking up your website and connecting with you on LinkedIn, reading your book and so on. We will put all the links to those in the show notes.
Thank you.
But perhaps you can give the website address.
Yes, it's www.virtuosolegal.com.
Super. Well, Liz, it's been an absolute pleasure. I think you've been incredibly generous as well with your advice and expertise, and I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're open for business life.
Accelerate your small business at Stadium Workspace, a free event that's part of Business Finance Week, hosted by British Business Bank. You'll meet the region's leaders in health tech and life sciences, discover cutting-edge innovation, and connect with potential investors. The date is Tuesday, 30th September. The venue, Sheffield Olympic Legacy Park. The cost, nothing. And the opportunity, potentially priceless. To unlock business opportunities, search online for Business Finance Week.
We're open for business life.
This is episode 399 of Business Live for curious entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs, broadcasting on FM and DAB radio through Sheffield Live and, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. And we've got a few funding opportunities for businesses and social entrepreneurs, some relevant to sole traders too. So first of all, if you are running a business in Sheffield, based in commercial premises in Sheffield, then you can access expert support and grants through the UK Shared Prosperity Fund's Low Carbon Project, which provides one-to-one advisory sessions, energy audits and capital grants too, of up to £12,500 to help reduce energy use and cut carbon emissions. Applications are open until March 2026 or until funding is fully allocated, and they will cover 50% of your project cost. If you want details, then you need to go to sheffield.gov.uk, the council's website, and then look up UK Shared Prosperity Fund Low Carbon Project. Okay, next funding opportunity is the Yorkshire Content Fund. Up to £500,000 worth of investment is available for projects in TV, film, video games and the digital sectors. You've got to be a producer who is either based in Yorkshire or wanting to film or establish a base in the region. The funder is Screen Yorkshire and you can find the details at screenyorkshire.co.uk. And another funding opportunity for people working in the arts and cultural sectors, youth charities, people working in universities, colleges and schools. This is the Royal Academy of Engineering and they have Ingenious Public Engagement Grants. £3,000 to £30,000 is available in this scheme. It's from the Royal Academy of Engineering, supported by the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, but you need to act fast. The deadline is the 24th of September, and you can get details via raeng.org.uk. We'll put the links to all of those funding opportunities in the podcast show notes as well. So if you look up Business Live for curious entrepreneurs, wherever you get your podcasts, you should find the show notes with the links. Next up, we've got some events for entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs. So first of all, a series of events. British Business Bank's Business Finance Week is back for 2025, bigger than ever, runs from the 30th of September to the 9th of October, a UK-wide campaign with virtual and in-person events covering all sorts of ways to better understand finance options to help you start, grow, and thrive in your business. Take a look at the Business Finance Week website for more details. And this week, Sheffield Live, this radio station, is celebrating 25 years of community broadcasting. What an achievement, and loads of people have cut their teeth broadcasting here on Sheffield Live. So, a party to celebrate. It's a fundraiser too, it's at Hagler's Corner, it's Friday the 19th of September. Details on the Sheffield Live website. Thanks for listening.
We're open for business life.
Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
On the 14th of August, our regiment was lost, and a ball from the enemy our lines came across. Well, it struck me in the temple, the blood trickled down. I staggered and I fell to the ground. Come here, says our captain, come here with great speed, for I fear by this bullet young Dismore lies dead. Water and brandy they poured out so free, and they turned me all over, my wounds far to see. But if I have my honey to bind up my wounds, one kiss from her lips would soon deaden the stones. And it's when I am weary and think of anxiety, down they do would fall.
Well, ask if we can have six in. If not, we'll have to have two. Well, you're coming up at our end, aren't you? So I'll get one with you. I won't let us have six in, especially not with the food. He could have just told us no, though. He didn't have to be rude. You see her with the green dress. She talked to me at the bar. Well, I can miss her many £2.50. We've only gonna buy a yard. Didn't you see she was gorgeous? She was beyond belief. But this lad at the side drinking a Smirnoff Ice came and paid for a tropical reef. And I'm sitting going backwards, and I didn't want to leave. I said, it's our green mate, buy a Hillsborough, please. Well, how funny was that sketch earlier up near that taxi rank? Oh no, you will have missed it. Think it was when you went to the bank. These two lads screaming up, proper shouting. Oh, we're next in the queue. The kind of thing that seems so silly, but not when they both had a few. Oh, well, calm down, temper, temper. We just shouldn't get so annoyed. Well, you're acting like a silly little boy. Oh, they wanted to be men and do some fighting in the street. They said no surrender, no chance of retreat. Are secure.
You know, tonight I'll make you mine, and not just 'cause you're pretty, baby. Something about you makes me crazy. I was just calling 'cause I'm near your place. I'm in my car, I can be there in 8. I got something for ya. I'm gonna treat you, so baby, relax. Grab what you need, 'cause we're not coming back. No, not till it's sober. It's the way you walk, it's the way you act. Something about your rhythm got my heart attached. Make me move like this when you move like that. Baby, I like what I see. You know, tonight I'll make you mine, and not just 'cause you're pretty, babe. You make me crazy. I'll pay you on, put your money away. I got this to show how much I appreciate ya. If you want it, you can thank it later. Flowers and candy and diamonds on rings. Big fluffy promises, they're not my thing. I don't need no drama. Give me the with you, no one else takes me the places you do. Get so hazy on ya. It's the way you walk, it's the way you act. Something about your rhythm got my heart attached. Make me move like this when you move like that. Baby, I like what I see. You know, tonight I'll make you mine, and not just 'cause you're pretty, babe. It makes me crazy. I'll pay you on, put your money away. I got this to show how much I appreciate ya. If you want it, you can thank me later. You can thank me, you can thank me, you can thank me later. me later. You can thank me, you can thank me, you can thank me later. You can thank me, you can thank me later.
Worth it right now. castrated ones standing in a corner smoking. They want to feel the bulges in their bands start to rise at the sight of a beautiful woman. They feel nothing but anger. Her skin makes them sick in the night. Nauseous, nauseous, nauseous. Summer in the city. I'm so lonely, lonely, lonely. I've been hallucinating you, babe, at the backs of other women. And I tap on his shoulder and he turn around smiling, but there's no recognition in their eyes. Oh, summer in the city means cleavage, cleavage, cleavage. And don't get me wrong, dear, in general I think I'm doing quite fine. Is this when it's summer in the city and you are long gone from the city? I start to miss you, baby, sometimes. When it's summer in the city and you're here, so long gone from the city, I start to miss you, baby, sometimes. Ooh, I start to miss you, baby, sometimes. Ooh, I start to miss you, baby, sometimes.
The boy stood on the burning deck, but my name is Martin Simpson, and you're listening to Sheffield Live on 93.2 FM and sheffieldlive.org, number one for Sheffield music.
You live in Phnom Penh.
You live in New York City.
But I think about you so, 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 so much I forget to eat.
It's 4 a.m., I check my email.
I'm too geared up to fall asleep.
So I write you back and count the days until we'll be together.
The first thing that I do is throw my arms around you
and never let go.
And never let go.
I call you from my hotel room. I'm sitting on the hallway floor. I know that we are so, 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 so tired. My phone has expired.
You only call me when you're drunk. I can tell it by your voice. It's the only time that you open up to me and tell me that you love me.
Thousand feet.